Hello.
It's your mandatory health coach calling, and you've been bad. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Well, I was always fascinated by the brain.
I don't know what the hell's about to happen to me. This is going to be crazy.
The first day I start taking care of patients as a doctor.
To reveal, to find the brain systems.
You recognize big, round
objects. You know, when you think about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea.
Yeah.
How many times have you,
over 25
years, whether it exists or not? I didn't see
that with your thumb.
The time when I'm healthy and I can almost hear the clock and I can feel like time's getting shorter.
On today's show, get out of the gym and jump up this wall. Don't toss that Nutella just yet. And a new high-tech tool in the life-saving trade. But first up, yoga during lunch and nutrition counseling right in your office sounds like a good deal. But as workplace wellness programs become more popular, some people are having second thoughts about the bargain they've made. Tanya English reports.
72-year-old Sally Myrick lives on 30 acres in rural Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Down a little gravel path. Hard to find.
She's a gardener. She's always outside. And she says she's disgustingly healthy for her age. This year, her insurance plan asked Myrick to fill out a wellness survey. There were questions about her eating habits, about stress, and emotions. Yeah. Myrick walks her dogs 2 hours every day in the woods around her home. She's an almost vegetarian, and she's been jazzercising for 25 years.
I love the dancing. And at my age, you don't get a chance to dance that much, so it's great.
Myrick says she was completely honest on her questionnaire, but now regrets telling the truth.
I told them I was taking an antidepressant. I told them I smoked 50 years ago.
She also said she could work on eating more fruits and vegetables each week.
I really think that that's what flagged me. But if that's what they're using, that's entrapment. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Soon after, Myrick was selected for health coaching. This telephone counseling is mandatory if she wants to keep her lower-priced insurance. But she's fighting that decision and hunting through the fine print of her health plan agreement.
I have a copy of it.
When the program did review her case, Myrick found out she was enrolled in coaching because her total cholesterol is high and because she takes depression medication. But she scored a 96 on her overall wellness assessment, and Myrick says her mood is good these days. Plus, she thinks the company is misinterpreting her medical information.
Hello.
When Myrick gets on the phone with her coach, she's still trying to get answers and trying to get out of mandatory counseling.
I think preventative health is great, and I think coaching can be great, but I am not a case for this. I still am in the dark as to why I am being told that I have to have coaching. Have you looked at my biometrics? Let me just read you one thing. Physicians typically assess an individual's total cholesterol.
Myrick just thinks they got it wrong.
My total is high because my HDL is high. Don't you understand? That's why it's high. You're just making blanket assertions, not knowing what the case is, what the person's history is.
On the phone, her health coach still wants to talk about exercise and diet.
Things are wonderful. Things are fine, right? I eat well and I exercise a lot. What else do you need to know?
Finally, she gives up.
All right, next Friday at 4. Thank you. I'll speak to you there. Ay, ay, ay.
Myrick gets her health coverage through the state group insurance program in Tennessee. A single person can save $600 in premiums and co-payments by agreeing to the wellness partnership. An average family can save $1,100 a year. Joan Williams is the plan's public information officer. To protect privacy, she won't talk about Sally Myrick's situation. But in general, people can be selected for coaching for many different reasons.
This includes responses to the well-being assessment, which is an online questionnaire, biometric and lab data, as well as medical and pharmacy claims.
Williams says only members with a chronic disease or people with high or moderate health risks are tapped for coaching.
You know, we currently have 45% of our partnership PPO members are obese. 24,000 plan members are pre-diabetic. So we are doing what we think we need to do to try to address these challenges with our plan.
Lots of big health plans have bought into the idea that workplace wellness programs slow disease and save money. But Al Lewis says there's plenty of evidence that they don't.
Pry, poke, prod, and punish is what they do.
Lewis is the author of the book Surviving Workplace Wellness, With Your Dignity, Finances, and Major Organs Intact. Lewis says too often wellness surveys are poorly designed and not good enough to actually improve health. His favorite example is from a fight that happened back in 2013 at Penn State University.
Among other things, if you were a woman, they asked you what your plans were to become pregnant, and if you didn't tell them, it cost you $1,200. Okay, and by the way, it's a completely useless piece of information because the problem pregnancies aren't going to be amongst the people who plan. It's going to be amongst the people who don't plan.
That particular fight was resolved, but there's still lots of debate, and questions come up all the time about what the plans are allowed to do. This spring, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission tried to clarify the rules. Regulators suggest that a program is voluntary as long as the reward or the penalty isn't more than 30% of the cost of a worker's health coverage.
There's nothing in my mind that's fundamentally wrong about those programs.
David Ash is a policy researcher and physician at the University of Pennsylvania.
Even if you're a patient with a chronic illness, you might be in front of a physician for only a couple of hours a year, but you spend the other 5,000 waking hours a year living your life.
Health is ultimately determined by those other 5,000 hours, Ash says. So now the government is looking for ways to enlist families, friends, churches, schools, and workplaces.
Employers in particular are people who can engage with you at a variety of times during your life and hopefully can do so in a way that promotes the goals that you have, not just the goals that they have.
Still, Ash understands the hesitancy to participate.
You don't normally think, well, gee, I've got a problem with my health. I think I'll just walk down to my neighborhood friendly HR director and ask for help.
And as for Sally Myrick, the woman who's fighting to get out of mandatory health coaching, she says she's dropping her workplace coverage. She wants to make Medicare her primary insurance, and that would be cheaper for her former health plan. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Health coaches calling you up, your employer telling you to get in shape. So much of being healthy sounds like a total drag, right? Chris McDougall, the author of the bestseller Born to Run, wants to return the fun and joy into fitness and exercising. His new book, Natural Born Heroes, explores what we can learn from everyday superhumans. He told me that what got him interested in this topic was a group of outlaws on a Greek island during World War II.
What arrested my attention was when I heard about a special operation on the Greek island of Crete, where the resistance realized, look, there's no way we're going to defeat 80,000 German soldiers. But maybe we don't have to. Maybe we just have to get one. What if we go capture the general? Now, this had never been done before. Never before in modern military history has any group tried to kidnap a commanding general from the field of battle. Because if you were smart, you would never try this. It's impossible. It's a suicide mission. And the reason why these partisans tried is because they had no experience and they were amateurs. And that's what really got me interested. I thought, how is it that amateurs can survive and thrive in unbelievably inhospitable conditions? And that's what sort of started me on this whole quest to figure out what are the transferable skills from their exploits in our lives.
We tend to think of heroes as people who emerge out of the shadows when times call for them. But in your book, you make a case that heroes can be built.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? Like we are willing to trust to luck. Like, oh, my house is on fire. Anybody around here feel like saving my baby? You know, the Greeks weren't satisfied with that for a very good reason, because the Greeks didn't have a standing army. They didn't have a standing police force. They didn't have a fire department. They couldn't outsource stuff the way we do. So every person was a policeman. Every person was a soldier. And for that reason, you wanted to make sure that every person was qualified to help in a crisis.
What were the skills you discovered in your renegade band of different people who captured this German general?
My favorite one was being fat adapted. To be fat adapted means you weren't constantly reliant on a steady stream of sugars like most of us are. Soft drinks and breads and rices and Doritos and things like that, you're constantly feeding fast burn fuel to your metabolism. Well, the Greeks perfected the Mediterranean diet, came from the island of Crete, and that is a very slow burn, low glycemic diet that lets you go a very long time with very little food.
What is a fat adapted diet? What does that mean?
Yeah, to be fat adapted means you're using fat as fuel. So you're using the slowest burn most energy efficient fuel that your body has. Like right now, I'm probably like 17% body fat, which means you could stick me on a raft and float me out in the Pacific and I wouldn't need food for like 3 months. This is what happened on the island of Crete. These guys were living on a starvation diet. One Cretan messenger would run 50 miles through the mountains on a diet of boiled hay. There is no calories in boiled hay, yet he survived.
How can we train our bodies to keep going and going and going? How do we get to do so much more?
It's interesting. You can see a good example if you ever watch the leaders at the front of a marathon and then everyone behind the leaders. The leaders look effortless. They're barely moving. They're essentially just bouncing along. And then the rest of us are just pushing ourselves along with heavy muscular exertion. What they're using is elastic recoil energy in their bodies. So the way to tap into that, though, is basically just change your bodily form so that you're actually using the balance instead of constantly shoving yourself forward.
How do you mean? How does that work?
Well, I've been fascinated by the art of parkour, which has a YouTube reputation as being like sort of young hooligans doing backflips off of garages. But what parkour is really about is rather than picking yourself up and shoving yourself over, just allowing yourself to bounce over, doing simple vaults and jumps, which allow you to just use that tendon bounce instead of muscular exertion.
You're doing this now. So how did you start?
I was intrigued by parkour. I thought, now, if parkour really is the science of natural flow, then women should be as good at it as guys. So I found an all-female parkour jam. It's a group that meets in London, and I went to train with them. And that was my first introduction to what parkour is all about. And this was this crazy tribe of women that would meet on Thursdays in a random part of the city and just attack the city. And what they basically do is you jog toward an obstacle, and then you just sort of flatten your arms and just spin over it. But basically what you're doing is just twisting and leveraging your body as opposed to trying to force through things.
Doesn't that require a whole change of mindset where you I could imagine myself just freezing up.
Yes.
And then breaking my neck or something.
Yes, exactly right. And that's what's so cool about it is it's a change of mindset. It's not a change of gear. You don't buy anything, but you just change the skill. And what's interesting to me was if you look at five-year-olds, they're already doing it. They're doing parkour. Five-year-olds are parkour masters. The problem is you put that five-year-old in a chair and say, don't move till you get that PhD. You know, you don't move for the next 15 years, and that skill ossifies. And that's what we're trying to reawaken.
Nowadays, we exercise a lot indoors. We run on treadmills. We lift weights, that kind of stuff. What do you think is a better way to exercise?
By chaining all the gyms shut. Don't let anybody inside. First of all, nobody wants to go inside anyway. The dropout rate in gyms is 60% in the first 3 months. And this is every single year, which tells you people go because they feel guilty and they leave because they hate it. So gyms are a failed experiment for one good reason. First of all, you're closing yourself off from the natural environment. And this idea of rewilding the psyche, test after test after test shows the same thing. You give a human exposure to the outside world and their brain is on fire. They do perform better on cognitive tests, on dexterity tests. Secondly, gyms are designed to basically move cattle through the chute. They're not there to actually let you exercise in an efficient manner. They're there to put as many bodies in a restricted place as possible. So you're restricted to machines which isolate your movements because it makes you feel like you did something even though it's utterly useless.
So it seems like as a society, we have exercise all wrong then.
Yeah. And I feel kind of a little bit weird to be the one saying that, but I don't think I'm the only one saying it. What you're noticing now are lots of different people approaching the problem and the same solution from different angles. There's a group called the November Project. These are a bunch of people that just get together ridiculously early in all weather to exercise outdoors, and they're constantly varying the exercise. You'll have a November Project leader of the tribe. And they'll say, okay, today we're going to run down this hill and up. And if someone tags you, you got to do 15 push-ups and don't get tagged. And they just make a big game out of it. And the tribes are exploding. CrossFit, obstacle course racing, a thing called MoveNat, natural movement, all the same thing, all saying gyms don't work. Get together as a tribe and have some fun.
Chris McDougall is the author of Natural Born Heroes, and he's also written Born to Run. Coming up, would you want your primary care doctor or cardiologist to know about your OCD diagnosis?
Clicking on a medical record and seeing that the provider has assumptions. The underlying assumption with OCD is that there are compulsive behaviors that are very obvious and evident.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Thank you. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca, offering resources to help patients afford and access their medicines. The AZ and Me patient assistance programs provided more than 382,000 patients in the U.S. with more than $670 million in savings in 2014. AstraZeneca Direct offers a range of patient support services, including delivery of brand-name prescription medications directly to a person's home. More at AstraZeneca-US.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. The medical field has been notoriously slow to embrace technology when it comes to patients' health records. The Affordable Care Act brought a $30 billion cash infusion from the federal government, and that has helped move things along. Now about 70% of American medical files are digitized. But that has posed many new questions, among them, what to do with people's mental health records? Should they be part of the equation, kept separately? As with many other aspects of this issue, different providers are following different paths.
So what we can see is that we can see all of their notes, and I can see...
David Oslin at the Philadelphia VA was, of course, showing me a fake health record used for training. He's a psychiatrist and chief of behavioral health at the facility, and when the VA went digital with its health records years ago, they decided to go all in with combined mental and physical health info, depression, addiction, diabetes.
It's all there.
Oslin says this approach is working well and has resulted in better care.
It's really important that health care be delivered by a community of providers, right? So a primary care doctor should not be making a decision about medications, not knowing what medications I'm prescribing.
Oslin says he likes to pull up medical records on his computer during his sessions with vets. He looks at them to assess the overall health of his patient.
You know, if I'm treating somebody for depression and they're not managing their diabetes, we know that those things interplay.
Or if he's treating a veteran with alcohol abuse issues, he'll show them how their liver is doing as a way of saying it's important to stay sober. Not all mental health providers are as excited about integrated records as Oslin. He says many are worried patients with a mental health diagnosis will be treated differently by other providers, or they feel it's a violation of their patients' privacy around very sensitive issues.
And I think in a lot of ways, from my perspective, this is just my opinion, but my opinion is that actually contributes to the stigma, right? It contributes to the lack of a dialogue with the other healthcare providers for that patient.
I wondered if vets mind this all-in-the-open approach, but Oslin says he explains right away that it's basically just everybody working together on one team.
And, oh, by the way, the veterans have full access to those records, too, and that's important. And that's been a transformation in most of healthcare as well.
Other health systems are more cautious about including mental health records into patients' electronic files. At Einstein Healthcare Network in Philadelphia, I met Chief Medical Information Officer Julie Massey. Actually, Dr. Julie Massey.
I'm a pediatrician by training, a general pediatrician, and then moved over into the IT world, bridging the gap between clinicians and IT.
This is a new specialty. There is now a board certification for clinical informatics for physicians to bring the clinical voice into digital health records. Massey's been glued to her computer, bringing health records at Einstein online and trying to make the right calls for access to patient info.
We are just beginning a number of the discussions of how to find the right balance between privacy and access to information for our mental health patients.
Right now, they are opting for limited access.
So there is some minimal information. There is some information available, including medications and diagnoses that is available to other clinicians. The therapy information, we do have some capability to protect specific sensitive information to be available only to appropriate relevant clinicians.
Meaning only mental health providers can see details from a person's history, such as past trauma or abuse or what they said in a therapy session. Massey says this allows everybody to check for potential medication interactions, but protects patients' privacy. This approach appeals to psychologist Erica Goldblatt-Hyatt. She teaches at Bryn Athens College and has worked as a mental health provider in hospital settings.
I'm of two minds about it. So on the one hand, as a provider, it's certainly convenient to have your patient's story written out for you.
But she also has a diagnosis of OCD, and as a mental health care consumer, she sees things differently.
Part of the therapeutic relationship is allowing the patient to tell their story of illness from their own words.
For example, if a primary care doctor sees the OCD diagnosis right away, as soon as they click on Goldblatt-Hyatt's medical records, that doctor might make assumptions about her or attribute symptoms to her OCD diagnosis. This concept is known as overshadowing. In addition to that fear, Goldblatt-Hyatt says mental health issues are unique. They are harder to define. It's tough to put them into neat categories.
I can't tell you my heart story from my heart's point of view other than to look at pathology or look at samples or labs, but I can tell you what it feels like to have OCD. I can tell you what intrusive thoughts feel like and how they affect my life. And when I'm using my own words and I'm making those choices with just my narrative, it feels empowering.
Right now, Erica Goldblatt-Hyatt is in need of a new primary care doctor. She could get her lengthy paper files transferred from the old office to the new one, but she's thinking of not doing that.
I want my new provider to hear the story, so why not start from scratch?
Letting your paper medical records rot away in a closet won't be an option in the future. And many providers and consumers say it's time for mental health care to come out of its silo. But the push for more integrated medicine will require a paradigm shift in healthcare that has yet to take root. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It's in your shampoo, your deodorant, your granola, cookies, and Nutella. Palm oil. It's made from the pulp of the fruit of the oil palm, and it's come under fire for being a bad actor in terms of the environment. Kaylin May Tobin leads the palm oil campaign for the advocacy organization Union for Concerned Scientists, and I asked him to describe the issues around palm oil.
As new land is cleared to produce more and more palm oil, and palm oil production has doubled in the last decade. Vast areas of tropical forest are cleared, and that not only destroys the biodiversity in those ecosystems, but also releases a huge amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, contributing to climate change.
And why has our hunger for palm oil grown so much over the past decade?
So palm oil is actually a great vegetable oil. It uses a lot less land than any other vegetable oil, so you get a vast amount more per area of land. It's also, in recent years, been used as a replacement in a lot of baked goods, processed foods, to replace trans fats, which there's increasing evidence that they are unhealthy for us.
And could palm oil be replaced with a choice that would be environmentally sound?
Well, palm oil in and of itself isn't bad. Replacing it with any other vegetable oil, you would end up having to use a lot more land. So what's more important than replacing palm oil is getting the companies that produce or use palm oil to commit to deforestation-free practices.
Is there any way for me as a consumer to know if I'm buying a product that contributes to deforestation in some way?
That's pretty tricky from a consumer standpoint. You would have to be able to trace all of the ingredients in your shampoo or your deodorant back to the source. It really falls to the companies that make these products to guarantee to their consumers that the products that they love and use every day aren't contributing to deforestation.
So how is that push happening?
Well, we're actually seeing a lot of success. It turns out that when consumers speak, businesses listen. So there have been a number of efforts with NGOs and consumer groups to convince these companies that they should be doing the right thing and sourcing deforestation-free palm oil. And we've gone in the last year and a half, 2 years, from one or two companies with deforestation-free commitments to well over a dozen.
There was recently a call to boycott Nutella coming out of France. What do you make of that?
Yeah, we all got a little good chuckle out of that in the office. From my understanding, the company that makes Nutella actually has a fairly good deforestation-free policy. And really, when it comes down to it, we don't think that boycotting a product is the answer. These companies really respond to their consumers in a positive way.
So this is definitely something that companies are taking seriously.
Most of them. There are a few holdouts still, and they are certainly falling behind their competitors.
Do you want to name them?
I can name them. We saw Wendy's actually come out with a policy last week that was very weak. Burger King is also a company that is well behind competitors like Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's.
Do you think consumers can keep all of this straight? I feel like we have so many things we have to keep in mind, whether I think it's shade grown with some things and this, that, and the other thing. So do you think consumers can keep all of this information straight and remember what they're supposed to look out for?
In an ideal world, they won't have to. Ultimately, what we want to see is change throughout the industry. We want all palm oil to be deforestation-free palm oil. So consumers don't have to think about it so much. They can go into a supermarket and know that any shampoo they buy, any cookies or cakes that they buy aren't causing deforestation.
Kaylin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kaylin May Tobin leads the palm oil campaign for the advocacy organization Union for Concerned Scientists. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Imagine you have a daughter who is not developing like other kids her age, but doctors can't tell you why. So you go from one appointment to the next, searching for answers, trying to figure out what the future holds. It took Mary Beth Hassel more than 7 years to get a diagnosis for her daughter Katie's rare genetic disorder, which was only recently discovered. WHYY's Carolyn Beeler visited Mary Beth and Katie, who's now 10 years old, at the family's suburban Philadelphia home and recorded their story for our series Patient Files.
Basically, since birth, Katie's always had some kind of something going on. She wasn't hitting her milestones when she should. And around 3 months, her eyes were crossed and they weren't fully focusing straight. She has benign external hydrocephalus. Her head was always off the charts. I think we've been to every ologist and optometrist under the sun. I've seen doctors I didn't even know existed before. They're telling you it's something genetic and then they're not sure what. So that was the problem. So it kind of makes you a very overreactive parent. Like I would ask them all the time, like, is she going to walk? Like, do you think she's going to crawl? Hey, kiddo.
Hi.
So on Fridays, Kate comes home from school, and it's usually, there's no really routine on a Friday. We're kind of just haphazard.
Take this off.
Mom.
What?
Is there ice cream?
Is there ice cream? Not right now, kiddo. You have to have dinner first. Good try, though.
When they did say, yes, we feel it's something genetic, we just don't know what it is yet. When they tell you that, your next scheduled appointment is for a year. So that when you come back to that next year's appointment, they'll say, anything different, anything changed, anything new. So we did that literally for 7 years with Katie.
I'm playing a game on my iPad. I'm showing her Token Nature. Is it a little fox?
Her brother's down there, and he always plays on any kind of electronic equipment, trying to get her to play a game that he really wants her to get into.
Do you like deer?
No.
Do you like foxes?
No.
Do you like bunnies?
No.
I think it's a little bit difficult for her.
No, you don't like rabbits? Do you like
he keeps trying, though.
Wolves?
No.
I just started investigating things, and I saw on the internet that there was a test called whole exome sequencing. So we had it done, and 20 weeks later, we had her answer, Coulin-DeVries syndrome. When she was diagnosed, she was the first one in the United States, and we stayed that way for a long time, for probably about a year and a half later. As soon as we found out what it was, jumped on the internet to find out if I could get any information. There's hardly any information. There's still really not that much information. When I found the Facebook group of parents, it was an overwhelming feeling of support because all those parents were all just so excited to find someone new comes on because we all want to get so much information. Like, are they anything like our children? Can we help them? Can we tell them what type of therapies we've done that have helped? And like just the other day, somebody wrote something on the Facebook page about their child's bone density. You know, now it's this thing. So now we're all like, we got to go to the doctor now and get our child's bone density checked.
I don't think it's right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. She's definitely opposite of me and my husband. She, like, seeks out attention and she's very outgoing.
I like toasting and I like toadines.
Can you sing something for me?
Let it go, can't hold it back anymore.
A year after she got diagnosed, I think it was in the summer of 2013, they had a family gathering, they called it, and it was in Indianapolis, Indiana. One father and mother came up to me and they said, you know what, your child gives us hope, because their daughter was like 2 or 3 at the time. And Katie was sitting over on a little blanket and she was sitting there reading a little book to a little Coulin baby. And Dad came over, he had tears in his eyes, and he was just like, you know, I'm so hopeful because of your daughter. It's become like a mission to try to like find other kids that have the same syndrome and help out those parents and let them know different things that they can do that might help their kiddo. If we can help somebody else not have to experience what we went through with not knowing for so long, I think it's a great thing.
The Hassell family is in Asheville, North Carolina this week for the annual parent-organized meetup for kids with Coulin-DeVries. Doctors Coulin and DeVries will both be there to answer questions about the syndrome. Carolyn Beeler produced this piece. Coming up, we get inside of this guy's head.
I was able to do this one weird thing when I was a little kid where I could kind of invert myself a little bit and feel as if I was part of my environment in a way that was very intense and almost a little bit uncomfortable.
An artist and his brain, which serves as the inspiration for his art, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations that increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. In the wake of a natural disaster like an earthquake or a flood, technology is entering the picture. It's coming to the aid of good old-fashioned manpower to save survivors trapped in life-or-death situations. As rescue workers searched for survivors in the rubble of the massive earthquake that hit Nepal on April 25th, they employed what's become a valuable tool – crisis maps. Pulse contributor Allison Bruzak has the story of this emerging emergency technology.
On April 25th, Rosie Karmakarye was getting ready to eat lunch at home in the Bhaktapur neighborhood of Kathmandu when the first earthquake hit. She relayed the story on a cell phone from Nepal.
I was in the kitchen. I couldn't do anything. It started shaking and everything started falling down.
It was just her and her younger sister. When the earthquake hit, She was on the fourth floor, but that quickly gave away as the foundation shook and she found herself falling halfway through the floor and the wall, with her legs in one room and arms in another. Miraculously, she survived the fall and tried to keep her crying sister calm.
I told her to take out the mobile from my pocket and I'll call my uncle for the help. But there was no connection. We were not being able to connect to anybody. And even if we tried, nobody was there to hear us.
Later, she found out neighbors outside the rubble could hear them yelling, but no one knew how to get inside the crumbled walls. They were together, but in their tiny village, who could know how to get them help?
If you go into the core area of Patan, for example, which is, you know, a really old part of town, you'll see, you know, every once in a while, a house that's turned into total rubble.
This is Prabhas Pokharel, a fellow at Kathmandu Living Labs. His organization is working to provide a crucial piece of infrastructure in Nepal, and one that was key in helping save people like Rosie. Maps.
One of the issues we had is in the early days, so we didn't know where people were most affected and where, you know, people providing relief should go.
The labs are working on a project to map Nepal before and after the earthquake. But these aren't your average piece of cartography. They look like Google Maps, but layered, with information about buildings and which are damaged, hospitals and which have open beds, and roads and which ones are too crumbled to drive on.
A lot of the hardest hit areas in this crisis were in the villages, in the remote areas.
That's why the labs' maps use data from local people. Communities know the landscape of their homes, and that's why they're some of the best cartographers.
The online volunteer community has contributed in an amazing way. So in a lot of the affected districts, we have, maps that are all of a sudden, you know, some of the best maps available for Nepal.
Rosie and her sister couldn't use a phone because the lines were jammed. This happened all over the country. But in many cases, the internet still worked. So one group used it to put a pin on the labs' map site and send an SOS.
We got a message from a district named Dolka where people said they needed rescue. It was a group of about 20 people that were staying in a school and they were really scared about landslides. So they put up a report and then we were able to call them and figure out what was going on.
People who build these maps call them crisis maps. They're online where anyone can access them. But it's not just in Nepal. Now, when a disaster strikes, crisis maps are one of the first pieces of aid that hit the ground.
If something bad has happened somewhere in the world, odds are we've helped out.
That's Chris McIntosh, emergency manager for ESRI, formerly known as the Environmental Systems Research Institute.
Vanuatu with the typhoon, Napa, California with the earthquake that they had, flooding in the Midwest, you name it, and we do this.
If you think of Kathmandu Living Labs as the next-door neighbor who wants to sell you his couch, ESRI is the IKEA. Chris says people who aren't familiar with crisis mapping think it's just about finding a little dot on a globe. But you can think of it more like a phone line.
Except instead of voice communications, you're sharing data and information. Everything is somewhere.
Chris says crisis mapping is the tool you hope you don't have to have. But for now, for survivors of the earthquake, they're just grateful someone's keeping an eye on them.
I was saved. I feel like I was saved by the God or something like that.
It's going to take Rosie's family another 5 to 6 months to begin rebuilding their home. And when they do, Kathmandu Living Labs will undoubtedly be one of the first to put them back on the map. For The Pulse, I'm Allison Bruzek.
Scientists have long been fascinated by how insects, tiny animals with even tinier brains, coordinate complex group actions. Colonies of weaver ants, for example, form living ladders with their bodies to knit together nests out of hanging leaves. New research out of Drexel University adds evidence to the idea that wasp colonies share a kind of distributed brain, allowing each wasp to cash in on the combined intelligence of its nest. Carolyn Beeler reports.
The story of these wasps, or why we care about them at least, starts with the story of us. Primates, monkeys, apes, and us humans all have brains that are way bigger than most mammals when compared to body size. Brain tissue takes a ton of energy to make and maintain, which has led scientists to a central question.
So the question is, why? What are these big brains doing? What do you get for having a bigger brain?
That's Robert Seyferth, a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania who studies the social behavior of monkeys in Africa. He says one way to understand why primate brains evolved to be so large is to look at how they live. Take chimpanzees.
These animals live their entire lives in highly complex social groups where animals form alliances. It's very much like a Jane Austen novel.
It's a competitive, hierarchical society formed from a mix of related and unrelated chimps.
You've got animals that are higher ranking, lower ranking, and these shifting alliances all present animals with an extremely complicated social problem.
The problem is figuring out and remembering who's allies with whom and who's still available for you to ally with to help you raise your kid or forage for food or warn you if a predator's nearby.
Among non-human primates and many mammals, social life got more and more complex. And as it got more complex, natural selection favored animals who could solve the problems posed by this complexity, that is, animals with bigger brains.
Brain growth was most pronounced in the frontal cortex, especially in humans and their predecessors. Seyferth points to Lucy, a skeleton of one of the earliest human ancestors ever found. She lived 3.2 million years ago and had a brain about the size of a chimpanzee's, less than a third of the size of a modern human brain. Since this so-called social brain hypothesis was first introduced decades ago, brain size and social networks have been linked in a variety of large mammals. But invertebrates were another story.
We really didn't know what was happening with insect societies.
That's Drexel University professor Sean O'Donnell, who several years ago started collecting wasps from around the world to study their brains. He compared a specific portion of the brain in six species of solitary wasps to 23 species of wasps that live in colonies, and he published his results this summer.
What we found, to our surprise, was that not only did the insects not match the vertebrate pattern, they actually showed exactly the opposite pattern.
That is, brain sections responsible for complex cognition were actually smaller in wasps that lived in colonies than those that lived on their own. O'Donnell thinks this difference between vertebrates and invertebrates, or wasps at least, can be chalked up to how their societies are formed.
A wasp society starts off with a single female founding a new colony and then having a bunch of offspring that then stick around and help her rear further sets of offspring. So the colony grows basically like a family grows.
This giant genetically related family unit works more cooperatively than primate societies, without all the complicated alliances of an episode of Survivor.
If the larvae are hungry and demanding food, if the nest is damaged and you need to collect materials to repair it, you don't necessarily have to figure that out on your own.
O'Donnell sees these tightly related wasp colonies as a kind of extended nervous system. Each wasp shares the distributed cognition of the nest, so each individual wasp brain can afford to be smaller. So to recap, primates need big brains to deal with everyone else's drama. But wasp brains get to be smaller when they live with others because they share brain power with the rest of the colony. So does this mean anything for us humans? Boston University biology professor James Tornello thinks it may help explain an aspect of the evolution of our brains.
Most people are aware that over the last 200,000 years, human brains have increased very dramatically.
But starting about 10 to 20,000 years ago, around the time agricultural societies began to form, human brains started to shrink. According to one estimate, they've lost about the size of a tennis ball.
That is as fascinating as why human brains became large in the first place. So we think that social insects give us a great opportunity to try to address that question.
Tornello does research similar to O'Donnell's on ants, and he believes that human brains, just like insects, started to lose mass as our increasingly complex societies began to make decisions collectively.
It's like the society is thinking for the individual, and therefore you don't need as much neural tissue to make such decisions because they're being made at a different level through a different mechanism.
This parallel between insect and human brain evolution is just a theory. But while he works to prove or disprove it, Tornello likes to think about how our brains will change over the next several thousand years. As more of the memory and problem-solving functions our brain used to handle get taken over by the cloud. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse, and from wasp brains to artist brains, we're wrapping up today's show with an ode to the neuron. A neuroscientist turned artist, fascinated by these tiny nerve cells, has been trying to capture their magnitude through a scientific experiment of sorts. And as The Pulse's Alana Gordon reports, it's no small task.
Greg Dunn grew up thinking a lot about how he thinks, and more specifically, how his mind perceives the world.
Like, for example, I would stare at the intersection of grout on tiles on the floor and just fixate on that one point for as long as I possibly could until my visual field would disappear.
Fast forward a couple decades, Dunn's a lot taller, has glasses, and has continued that exploration through meditation and pursuing a PhD in neuroscience. Because to Dunn, it's kind of a no-brainer. The brain's at the core of our perception. And yet the billions of neurons that comprise it and chaotically mix to create consciousness, thoughts, and emotions continue to baffle scientists.
What an insane concept it is that you start with these cells which are just splaying themselves out randomly into the space around them. And then just through the collective behavior of all of them, organize themselves into these incredibly elaborate circuits.
Dunn spent years examining these basic building blocks under the microscope. It wasn't just the science that struck him. The random patterns of neuron branches drew him in. He made connections outside the lab.
You see it in cracks in the pavement or ice. You see it in lightning bolts. You see it in the orientations of galactic superclusters.
To try and express the neuron's essence, Dunn began practicing a Zen painting technique on the side. It involves simple ink strokes. Imagine delicate trees with pink floral clusters on a rice paper scroll that, at a closer look, are actually neurons mixed with Alzheimer's tangles. After finishing his PhD at Penn, Dunn moved into the art studio full-time.
Pretty low-tech environment here. I mean, the studio is kind of a mess.
Dunn's fourth floor spot, just north of Center City, has a typical artist setup. Work tables, paints, and chemicals. But he's brought in some high-tech science.
And now we're putting it down on top of the photoresist, which is laminated to a piece of steel.
Dunn wanted a deeper way to convey the vastness of the brain. Enter Brian Edwards, an applied physicist at Penn with a specialty in optics.
I'm interested in solving problems, and Greg's art presents a lot of unique problems. And he and I have had a lot of fun in trying to figure out how to create a physical manifestation for what his vision is.
The two developed a technique called micro-etchings. The basis are Dunn's carefully sketched neurons. But through a series of transformations, they apply reflective technology, similar to what's used in microchips, to build a new dimension to the work.
Somebody will walk up to the thing, they'll kind of gasp, they'll move their head around it a little bit, and they'll look completely confused, and then they'll say, "What is this? How did you do this thing?"
Again, Edwards.
Every piece that we do is very specifically illuminated.
As a person moves around a piece, the reflection of light creates the appearance of neurons in action. Pulling this off has involved a lot of programming on Edwards' part and teeny tiny patterns imprinted on metals and plastics. Dunn points to a completed poster-sized work. It's of the hippocampus, the part of the brain where memories take shape.
The hippocampus is great because it has such a wide variety of different types of neurons. You have your dentigyral cells, your pyramidal neurons, you have all sorts of inner neurons. You have these huge ropes of axons.
Lights turn the piece into a rainbow burst of layer upon layer of intricate neurons, some shooting from one section to another.
So this would be the perforant path. These are the axons which are coming in from the entorhinal cortex. That information is sent in. This is basically me painting a forest. Like, the only difference between this and painting a landscape is that I used a microscope to get my inspiration.
Science groups and journals have commissioned Dunn's work. He says the process has been gratifying and humbling.
When you actually make something, I think that you have a much greater understanding of what it is that you're dealing with. And in as complex as these images and pieces of work that we're making are, they are millions of times less complex than the brain actually is.
Dunn's working on a giant cross-section of the brain for the Franklin Institute. A showcase of his work is now on display at the Mutter Museum. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And we have some beautiful photos of Dunn's work on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Karen Shakurji is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. And hello to our new listeners tuning in to WITF. We're happy to be on your station. Did you miss some of this show, any of our previous shows? You can subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes, or you can find it on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us an email, your questions, your feedback, your ideas. We love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.